Okay, back in chapter 9 of Daniel, I won't make any promises to you. I thought maybe we'll get through this, but if we don't, we'll be back next week, and we'll get through it then. So we've got a lot of time this evening, but we're going to read verses 24 to the end of the chapter. So as we looked at the really getting into these 70 weeks, I felt like, you know, we covered that the first seven was about coming out of that period of 49 years to rebuild Jerusalem when a decree was given. So our first 7 weeks was about the rebuilding. So this was important to Daniel because he knows that captivity, those 70 years of captivity, that he's about there. And once that decree was made to go back and not just to rebuild the temple, because there was a couple decrees given, but the decree was given to rebuild Jerusalem. That started the counting of the 70 weeks. And so those first 7 weeks was the 49 years. And then we got into the 62 weeks, and they run successive. Now, they break it up, but they are successive in that counting. So the first 69 weeks, it's those years when they started counting to rebuild Jerusalem until we get to the end of the 69th week. Those years are one after the other. That time was 434 years. And we see that there is a lapse in time, though. So we've got 69 We're going to say weeks because that's how Daniel's speaking. But all of these years, everything was flowing just like the prophecy said. And then all of a sudden, we've got this lapse in time. And we're still waiting for the 70th week. So it's been a lot more years that we're waiting for the 70th week than it took to fulfill the first 69. So we're in that lapse of time right now. So our focus tonight really is going to start in verse 26. In verse 26, it talks about, and I'm teaching from the New American Standard, so the King James Version is going to say this differently, and that's really the part that I want to focus on. In verse 26, it says, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off. Does anybody have King James Version? What's it say? Okay, well then you just proved me wrong that what I thought didn't matter. So there's translations that talk about the anointed one will be cut off. So King James says, Messiah, does anybody have a translation that says the anointed one will be cut off? Thank the Lord somebody has one. What version do you have, Paul? NIV. Okay, that's that alternative Bible. So if we look at it, and I believe it says Messiah will be cut off because that's who it's talking about. But I think if we go back in the Word and we look at the word anointed, because in some translations it says the anointed one will be cut off, I think this will start to make sense on why Daniel writes the way he writes, because of the people that he's writing to and what their understanding would be. If we would look at the nation of Israel, and we know this prophecy is about Daniel's people, so it's about the nation of Israel. Everything about what we're talking about now is how it affects Israel. So this is something we have to keep in our minds. This is for his people. And it's not so much the Gentile nations anymore. This is about his people. So if he used the words anointed one when he wrote originally, the priest in that Levitical line, Leviticus chapter 4 and verse 3 talks about the anointed priest. We can look in 1 Samuel chapter 12 verses 1 through 3 where Saul was anointed king. So we know that the kings of Israel also were anointed, and they were called the anointed one. We can look in the same book in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 13 that David was anointed. And it was by Samuel, but it was because of God's direction. We know if we could follow that path of David, David was anointed king and Saul lost favor with God, but it was a lot of years before David became recognized as the king of Israel, but he was God's anointed. So when we look at David then, David, as he is king in 2 Samuel chapter 22, verse 51, and then also in chapter 23, verse 1, is referred to as the anointed one. Now, Daniel's prophecy is not about King David because Daniel was about four centuries after David. So we know he's not talking about David, but what's important about the line of David? Who would come from the line of David? And what would we call Jesus? The anointed one. And if Daniel originally wrote talking about the anointed one, the people that are reading this, the people of Israel, would know this was a messianic prophecy, that he was talking about the Messiah that would come. So it would be more clear to them what they're reading than maybe what it would be to somebody else that's reading it. But this would hit home with the people of Israel, that they know Daniel's talking about future things, and he's talking about the one, the anointed one, that was going to become, that would come for them. Initially, if we think about anointing, it would refer to oil being poured on the heads of whether it was the priest or the kings. And that was just really a symbol that they were set apart, that their responsibility and their duty was different than those around them, that they were called out by God for special purpose. We could look at Messiah and we know that he was sent here for a special purpose. So for Daniel in his time, they would understand this in a messianic context. They would know that Daniel was talking about Messiah. It wasn't just some king or somebody or a priest. This had special meaning. So if we look at it that way, and then when it says, of course, in our version, at least that what I have, it says in 2 weeks Messiah will be cut off, or if it was the anointed one will be cut off, then this should have been a sign to the people. And we think about what happened in the days of Christ when Israel turned their back on Jesus. We think of all the warnings that the people had. That this, he came just like he was prophesied he would come. He did the very things that it was prophesied that he would do. The events happened just like they said it would happen. And it makes you wonder, what they miss in all this? You know, what we know what they were looking for. They were looking for someone that would save them from Rome, just to deliver them personally, is what it was, for their own benefit. But as we look at that, what's it mean then to be cut off? And it simply means to be excommunicated or to be separated from. And in the case of Christ, the Messiah, we know that means when he's cut off, that he's killed. So when we would look at the timeline of the 7 weeks plus the 62 weeks, a lot of people think the end of the 62 weeks, which if you make them successive, is the end of the 69th week. So if we think it as a whole, a lot of theologians thought that the 69th week would be at the birth of Christ. That would be really about the triumphal entry, because the events right after that is when Christ was cut off. And he didn't die just right then, but that's when everything started taking place, when they would turn their back on Christ. So we would have to look at, that's the timeline at the end of the 69 weeks, is that final week of his life. It doesn't stop counting at Christ's birth, but it stops counting right after that triumphal entry. So he's rejected by Israel. He's crucified, and verse 26 also says that he will have nothing, meaning that the people gave him nothing that he deserved. You know, I think we got to this point last week. What are some things that Christ would have deserved from the people? Respect, honor, worship, what kind of things did Christ get? what made him cut off? And I think as we go in a little bit deeper into this, you know, Jesus wasn't accepted. We talked this morning in the communion, and I found something that was interesting, and I've done a lot of studying on the Passover because Kevin is doing a great study in our Sunday school about the Passover and the timeline. And I didn't realize that those in Galilee would observe the Passover on Thursday. Those that were north, where most of Judea observed it on a Friday. And it made it interesting that Christ could observe Passover on that Thursday and be the Passover lamb on Friday. And we think, why would he observe what the people of Galilee did? Because that's really where he was from and where his ministry mostly was. Why was his ministry in Galilee and not Jerusalem? Because the people of Jerusalem didn't want him. They didn't want to hear what he had to say. He was shunned by that capital city. So most of his ministry was done away. So largely he was neglected. He wasn't accepted by people throughout his ministry. It wasn't just in this last week. This was the one that they waited for. And as Daniel is prophesying this so many years before, the one that you're waiting for really is what he's saying. You're going to cut him off. And you're going to kill him. And this is the anointed one, but he'll be cut off. John chapter 1, verses 10 and 11 says, he was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. So if we think then, if you've ever been shunned by a friend, or we see this happen a lot in school, so school teachers get to witness this a lot. There's a group of friends, and maybe at some point somebody does something that the people don't like, that the group doesn't like. What happens to the one person? They get shunned and they kind of get displaced. You know, I think it happens a lot with girls more than it does boys, is you're not our friend anymore. But how does it make that person feel? It's a terrible feeling. You know, and trying to, you hope that you're not the parent of one of the children that's shunning somebody, but you also hope you're not the parent of one that's being shunned. So if we look at it that way with Christ and we think, okay, well then who was Christ cut off from? So we would know that it was the people like the Pharisees, and we could think, well, big deal. Everybody at some point goes through a time where somebody's against you. That always happens. Somebody that's close to you betrays you over something. And we get through that. We would say that's part of life. That's just human nature. That's the things that people do. So we know that Christ was cut off by man. And that is, it's not a big deal for us to look at that, because we know that's what led Christ to the cross, was because man turned their back on Christ. So when he was betrayed by man, if we look at the events leading up to the crucifixion when Christ was on trial, who betrayed him? Who else betrayed Christ? Who was with Christ all the way through the trial? I would say everybody. Christ was alone through the trial, and all those disciples, when Christ was arrested, what happened to the disciples? They scattered. So we always think about Judas and that Peter denied him. Jesus was betrayed by everybody. Everybody ran from him and didn't want to be associated with him. He was cut off from life itself. We know that he died. But maybe the one that we don't think about very much, and you and I have never been here. When we belong to the Lord, we've never experienced this, we won't experience this. But he was cut off from God. And we've never experienced that as believers. We know that because of what Jesus did, we have a relationship with God, that he won't cut us off. We may be corrected, but he won't cut us off. But for a time, when Jesus took on sin, God turned his back on his son, and the full wrath, God's hatred of sin, we can't fathom how much God hates sin. Christ is a picture of the torment that he went through, of how much God hates sin. And God poured that out on Jesus, and he had to, because we had to have that unblemished lamb. And in Matthew 27:46, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And we would think Christ died for us, and that's a good thing. What did Christ go through? Because who did he have on those last moments on the cross? We could say he was alone. We've probably had times in our lives where we were lonely. Nobody in here could probably ever say, I was completely alone. I had no one I could call. I had no one I could reach out to. We haven't been there. When Christ was cut off, he was cut off completely. Now, we know there's good that came from that. You know, to me, if we think about and we start reading those gospel accounts and we read about the trials and we read about the abuse that Christ went under, the whipping, the mockery, all that he went through, the disciples betraying him, those that were dearest to him that he spent his ministry with, that were afraid to be associated with him, that's a really good picture of what separation from God looks like. And we look at that in a lost and dying world, what they're going through, they don't even understand it yet. But that picture of Christ as the sacrificial lamb, that is separation from God. And there's nothing good to look at with that. But we can also look back on it now, knowing what a sign of redemption. And as Daniel is writing this, and he's talking about the anointed one being cut off, this is the event that Daniel is referring to. You know we can be redeemed because Christ was willing to obey his Father. He knew what he had to do to appease God's hatred for sin. And he did it willingly, and he did it on our behalf. You know, and the angel that's talking to Daniel and is relaying this message to him and trying to give him the interpretation, when he starts to talk about the city being destroyed, he doesn't give exactly when it's going to happen. We just know that it's after this 62 weeks or 62 plus 7. So after the 69 weeks is fulfilled and Christ is cut off, we know that at some point after that time that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. And if we keep reading in verse 26, it references the people of the prince who is to come. So I think the key here is that we don't jump too far ahead, because who is the prince that is to come? When it comes to talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, who would that prince that is to come be? The Antichrist. So we can't read too much into this yet, because Jerusalem in AD 70, which was about 33 to 37 years after Christ's death, which is almost 40 years after Christ died, Jerusalem was destroyed. And it was by Titus, a Roman general, led the charge, and he was the instrument that was used. So Titus isn't the Antichrist, and that's not the prince that was to come. But if we look at that again in verse 26, it says the people of the prince who is to come. If we would look at Antichrist, what kingdom is Antichrist supposed to be a part of? Roman Empire. The reemerged Roman Empire is what he will be a part of. The people of the prince who is to come would be the people of the Roman Empire. We're just talking about two different time periods. So it is the people that represent that empire are the ones that would move in and destroy Jerusalem. Destroy Jerusalem. So if we look at Luke, just turn to Luke chapter 21. And Jesus predicts these events that will happen. Luke chapter 21, and we're going to look at verses 20 through 24. And it says in verse 20, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city. Because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled." Now, if we look at what Jesus is saying, I think there's a double prophecy in this. He's talking about the events that will happen in AD 70 when Jerusalem will be laid waste. It'll be destroyed. But he's also referring to the end as well, because they'll be invaded by the Gentile nations. This will keep happening to Israel until the end. Who hates Israel now? Like everybody. If you're not part of Jews, who are you? You're Gentile nations. We can look through history, even after this, where Israel has struggled with other countries. So what Jesus is saying here, and if we look back then at AD 70, which is just not even 40 years after Christ lived on this earth, when Titus invaded, he destroyed everything. He wiped out Jewish records, which, and I just think this is great too, anybody that claimed to be the Messiah today would have no way to prove it. Nobody kept records like the Jews, and they kept these, they were real big on their lineage. So you could track Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, Luke, track Jesus through the line back through Joseph, all the way to Adam. Luke tracks it through the line of Mary. They track Jesus' lineage to get to King David. You couldn't do that today, because when Titus destroyed Jerusalem, he destroyed everything. All of the records were gone. Things were burned. Josephus, the historian, was taken captive. He recorded the things that he could that took place, but all other records from the city were gone. I mean, it was utter destruction of Jerusalem. These are some of the things that happened. 500 mercenaries were nailed to crosses every day. They destroyed a forest from making so many crosses. This is the destruction that took place in Jerusalem. And we would think today if something like that went on, but we can't imagine something like that happening today. But this was the hatred for the Jewish people by the Romans. There were so many dead bodies that they couldn't bury them fast enough. So what do you think the stench would have been like in that area? Yeah, so not only was Jerusalem a wasteland, I mean, it really was then like a cesspool. It was disgusting. It was gross. The Jews that were able to survive would die of starvation. They would chew on anything they could get, some of them even eating their own children. And we can't imagine an event like that. But this is something that happened. The city was burned. The temple was burned. By August of 70 AD, the Romans had put up their banners. They sacrificed to their idols. And 10,000 Jews had their throats slit in Damascus, and others died as gladiators. So they used them for sport. I mean, this is what happened to a city that turned their back on their Messiah. And we think that our sins don't have results. But this is the kind of things that happen to the Jewish people. And we can look, even as we go into today, in our age, the things that we remember in our recent history, this pattern has continued for the Jewish people. As late as in the 1940s, 6 million Jews were executed by Adolf Hitler. You know, these are things that If you think God doesn't still have a covenant with the nation of Israel, they shouldn't even exist. They faced so much death and destruction by everybody that is around them. But in May of 1948, Israel becomes a nation again. And this would start the process of leading up to the 70th week. So we're not in that 70th week, but when Israel was, they were scattered. So when they were destroyed in AD 70, those that could get away fled to every nation around them. And it wasn't until 1948, so I mean, we think about that, from 70 AD until 1948 is when they established themselves as a nation or a country again. But where are Jews today in the world? They're still scattered. They still have to come back, but they're largely scattered still today. So the gap in the time will end. What we look for that 70th week is when the Antichrist will make a covenant with Israel. That's what will start that 70th week. Nobody in this room should see that. Because what should happen first? The rapture of the church should happen. When Antichrist makes covenant with Israel, that gap in time that we're still waiting for, that will come to an end. And then that will start that 70th week, which will be the last 7 years. So we can look at verse 26 and look at that verse as most everything that that verse talks about is now historical. It's not future prophecy to us, but it's things that happened in the past. You know, because it speaks of destruction. It talks about its end coming with a flood. I've tried to look into that more of what that actually means. And what most people think is that the way that Jerusalem was destroyed was much like what floods do to landscapes. So if when you see something that's been flooded real bad, or let's just think about hurricane damage. When hurricanes come in, what do? Yeah, they destroy everything. They knock trees down in half. You've probably seen pictures of floods along riverbanks where people build their houses right on the edge of a riverbank. And when a flood comes and the waters get too high, what happens to the homes? They just get washed right out. It's a picture of what the destruction of Jerusalem looked like. So the land lay desolate. And it's interesting the way Daniel, this vision is given to him, because what happened to Jerusalem after Daniel was led into captivity? It wasn't so much waste, but the land laid desolate because of punishment for them abusing the Sabbaths, that they wouldn't give the land their land Sabbaths, and God really set everybody into captivity to where the land laid desolate to rest. Now it would be desolate because of destruction. But again, because of judgment for sin. But God doesn't put an end to his nation. Why doesn't he? Because he has a covenant with them. And God does not break his covenants. He's faithful. Now, if we would look at Zechariah chapter 14, Zechariah speaks a lot about the end times. And let's look at the first five verses of Zechariah 14. And he's talking about really here the final days on earth. So we will see where verse 26 of Daniel, we can look at it historically, and it's not talking about the future. Because if we keep in mind Jerusalem being destroyed, really uninhabitable. If we read Zechariah 14, which is talking about the end, it says, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured. The house is plundered, the women ravished, and half of the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. In that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. You will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Azel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. So this is speaking about the very end. We're looking at the battle of Armageddon when Christ comes and he judges sin once and for all. But it's talking about the city of Jerusalem. So if Daniel verse 26 is talking about the very end, that's a city that's laid waste, that's desolate, that is really uninhabitable. And Zechariah, when he's talking about the end, it's a city that's occupied. It is ravaged with war, but there are people there. So we know that's two different times. So we believe what Daniel is speaking of in verse 26 is when it's destroyed by Titus the Roman. But it's destroyed by the people of the prince to come, not by the prince to come. What will happen? Zechariah gives a very good account. I believe this scene at the end of the tribulation, when Christ comes back and he's on the Mount of Olives, it says when he stands on the Mount of Olives, what happens to the Mount of Olives? It splits in half and it creates a valley. And that valley will be the path of escape for the remnant, the believing remnant that will get out before Christ goes in and destroys the enemy once for all. That he destroys sin. In that same process, so we know there's going to be a topography change. That's the big word for today. The landscape is going to change when Christ goes to the Mount of Olives. And how this all happens, I suppose we'll be there because the saints will come with him. As this all is happening, I think we're going to see, there's some things that's going to happen all at once. Christ is going to save the remnant. So those that will make it, those believers that make it through the great tribulation are going to have a pathway out of Jerusalem. A pathway to safety. Christ will move in, he'll destroy sin. And at that same time, the millennial kingdom, the city will be renovated. Now, we've heard about a lot of miracles. Some of us have witnessed a miracle. That is going to be one, like HGTV will have nothing for this one. This is a renovation process that's going to happen very suddenly. That's what Zechariah chapter 14, 1 through 5 is speaking of. So we know at the end, Jerusalem's not going to be laid waste. It's going to be transformed and renovated. Christ will destroy sin. That's where it's going to happen. And it's going to be renovated into the millennial kingdom. I suppose we'll get to see it happen, and it's probably not going to be any big deal to us. But those are the events that it's going to happen. So we get then to the 70th week in verse 27. We know now it's a period of 7 years. It's all future. So 69 weeks are fulfilled of Daniel's prophecy. This is the last part that hasn't been fulfilled yet. So as we look at it today, it's still future. We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't have a clue. People have sold books guessing the date, and they sell books the next year guessing the date. And somehow they're bestsellers 2 years in a row. We think, what foolish people buy these books because people think they know when the end is. I personally don't care when that time is. I know I'm ready. I hope the Lord waits a little bit because there's a lot of lost people. So I don't want to get wrapped up in when the end is because there's still work to do right now. But we know it's not chronological to the first 69 weeks. 69 weeks, they were chronological. We're just in that gap period. So this time that we're in, we would know it as the age of grace. God is still allowing people to come to him. It's unknown to the prophets. It's unknown even to Christ. And Mark chapter 13 and verse 32 says, "But of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." Now that's interesting. But do you think Christ will be ready when God says it's time? I think he'll be ready and he'll move quick. So the Antichrist will make a covenant with the people of Israel. But this is the interesting part too. He'll make that covenant with the unbelieving portion of Israel. Those that are always looking for some sort of safety. You know, but we can ask, how do we know that it's the Jews? How do we know that it's not just some people in Israel? Because we don't know who's going to inhabit it. And all different kinds of people inhabit it. We know there's a large Muslim faction there. But we know they'll make covenant with the Jews because what verse 24 tells us. Verse 24 says, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people. And as Daniel's getting this prophecy, who's your people referring to? It's to the Jews. It's to Israel. It's that nation. So we know that the Antichrist, this covenant will be with the unbelieving part of Israel. It tells us the time of 70 weeks is about your people. And in verse 27, when it says, he, now that's referring to verse 26 when it's referring the prince who is to come. So in verse 26, the prince who is to come, that wasn't Titus who led the charge to destroy Jerusalem. The he of verse 27 is referring back to verse 26. That's the Antichrist. So he makes a covenant for 1 week, which is 7 years, but we know that that covenant will be cut in half. 3.5 years into it, he's going to turn on the Jewish people. You know, he's going to use them to really what he thinks is to set up his kingdom. So these are some interesting, I think, facts too, is that Russia is going to play a role in this. The Gog and Magog, there's a few countries, but Russia is one of those countries. They're going to be a factor in this in the end. And so I've thought about, I know we're close, we're closer than we've ever been to the end. We could still be 100 years away. We could be many years, we could be a couple days. The interesting part to me with the events that's going on in the world, what partner does Israel not have in this Iran thing? Who's going to make covenant with Israel after the rapture? What nations? Who is it? If we look at the Roman Empire, are any of those nations on board with what's going on? Does Israel have a friend right now? They have the United States. I'm not even sure the United States will even be a factor in all of this. But the one that's going to make covenant with them, they're not even supporting Israel in this. So I think as we look at that, we know we're close and we know things can change quickly. But Russia will have a role because what Russia wants is they want, what's the whole battle with Ukraine about? It's about getting the ports, the shipping access, things in and out. And it's about oil. And if it's ever about oil, what's it about? Money. So we know that Russia will be involved. Israel is going to need help from Europe. The logistics make really the most sense, but it's what the Bible teaches us too. When we look back at the beast, we know that Roman Empire is going to reemerge, and that's going to be the ones that's going to give Israel the impression that we're going to be the ones that's going to protect you. And we think of a nation of Israel, who's their protector? It's like they always forget that God is the one that just, somehow they keep making it through. Year after year, that nation keeps making it through. And they give credit, I guess, to everything except for the one that keeps getting them through. All of the things that they've been through as a country. But they will still make this covenant with the Antichrist. I think the problem with Israel is they're going to be, they'll be comfortable. And when they make that covenant with the Antichrist, he'll give them some false protection. And things are going to be good. There's going to be false peace in the land. And they're going to think, what my assumption would be, they'll think the Antichrist is going to do for them what they wanted Messiah to do for them. Because Messiah just wanted, Israel wanted Jesus to deliver them from the oppression they were under the Roman government. You know, we think about that and think what all the coincidences that play out. The Antichrist is going to be the one that will make them powerful and a force, but they'll be with the Roman government. And we think this doesn't even make any sense, but that's the ones that they'll look to. The temple will be built, the sacrificial system will be back in place, and at 42 months or 3.5 years, Antichrist will put a stop to all sacrifices. He'll break the covenant. He'll get them sucked in to being this right where he wants them. And then everything will change. In Mark 13:14, Jesus says, "But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains." Antichrist will set up an image of himself in the temple. He will demand that everybody will worship that. That will be the abomination of desolation. It's setting a false idol up in the temple. And people will be required to worship. And if you don't worship, you'll be killed. Now, he has made a covenant with a nation that wants to go back to their sacrificial system and really go back to the practices of Mosaic law. What's that going to do? What's that going to lead to when he says, "No more, this is what you'll worship now"? We know there's going to be mass murders in Jerusalem because Antichrist won't put up with it. He's made a promise with them. But we can look at the Jewish people. They're very strong in the things that they believe. And when they want to keep sacrificing the way that they are, they're going to be pretty reluctant to bow to some idol in a temple because that will still defile the temple. That'll be blasphemy. Revelation 13:15 says, "And there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many do not worship the image of the beast to be killed." So he'll put an end. And I find this interesting too. Antichrist won't even put up with false religion anymore. So who's going to have a problem with the Antichrist at this point? What would we say would be the fastest growing religion in the world today? Islam. What kind of problem is that going to be? Can you think of the chaos and just the killings that could happen everywhere if Muslims have to worship Antichrist? You know, because at some point, false religions will be accepted too. I think Antichrist will accept everything, but when he turns, it will be all about him. And if you don't worship him, it's a death sentence. Revelation 13, I'll give you these verses that you can read. It's verses 3 through 7. But it tells us that Antichrist will be given power. And he'll be given power by God. He'll be allowed to do things. So I think that's one thing we need to remember. He won't do anything that he's not allowed to do. It's all divine. God allows these things to happen. And he'll massacre many saints. So there's many believers that it's going to die during the tribulation. People that come to a saving faith. And when this happens, if you're a believer, there's no way you're going to bow down to some image in a temple. There's no way you're going to give up your faith in Christ to worship some guy. And he'll be allowed by God to massacre those saints. Really, he's doing them a favor by killing them and sparing them from the very end. But it's going to be the new normal. That from that last 3.5 years, it's not a temporary thing. I believe as bad as we think the Antichrist could be, he's going to be much worse. We can't fathom what life will be like in those last 3.5 years. He will desolate or ruin what the Jews considered to be sacred, which is their temple, in the presence of God. And for that last 42 months, there won't be any covenants with any other nations. Antichrist will do whatever he wants to do, the way he wants to do it. He will be the one that has absolute power, but not just in Jerusalem. Antichrist will control the world. Everything that happens in the world will be based upon what he wants. We make jokes about dictators today. We haven't even seen nothing close to what this is going to be like. But the good news at the end of this chapter, in verse 27, it says, let's just read that verse again. And he will make the middle of the week, he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. What's that? What that is saying, the one who brings on the abomination of desolation, the Antichrist, sets up that image in the temple, the one who desolates the temple will be made desolate. And that's prophecy that Christ will come back. He'll deal with Antichrist directly. He's going to be the first to go. And he's fortunate. He gets a direct ticket. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. He misses the great white throne judgment. He'll go directly to the lake of fire. You know, we think God doesn't hate sin and hate the evil ones. His just is sovereign and it's complete. But Christ will wage war on sin when he returns. And then what Zechariah 14 talks about, when we see where the Mount of Olives will be split and this valley will be made, and when Christ defeats sin once for all, there's a transformation where we will have the millennial kingdom.